Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of scientist interviews and music. I'm Jorge Salazar. We'll open with a scientist soundbite.
The one piece of the puzzle that I think we do understand well is that as the atmosphere warms, it can hold more water, and thus the water in the atmosphere increases with warming.
You're listening to Frank Wentz, Director of Remote Sensing Systems in Santa Rosa, California. Predicting when it'll rain just got a whole lot trickier, said Wentz, because of human-caused global warming from CO2 emissions. Dr. Wentz uses satellites to measure changes in the water high above in Earth's atmosphere, not just from rain and clouds, but the invisible water vapor that makes up 99% of the water in our atmosphere. Here to tell us more about how global warming affects rainfall is Frank Wentz. Welcome to the program.
It's nice to be here.
Now, what are the most important elements that go into studying the connection of greenhouse gases that warm the planet and changes to rainfall patterns? And in other words, in answering the question of your study of how much more rain will global warming bring?
Well, the one piece of the puzzle that I think we do understand well is that as the atmosphere warms, it can hold more water, and thus the water in the atmosphere increases with warming. Now, the more difficult question is how much of this additional water is going to turn into rain. Just because there's more water in the atmosphere doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be that much more rain. The rainfall is also determined by the air circulation. It's sort of like a conveyor belt. And even though the packets on the conveyor belt contain more water, if the conveyor belt slows down, then there'll be less rain. But that said, the climate models are trying to model a very complicated process. But my focus really is on the satellite measurements themselves, rather than trying to theoretically model the Earth's response to various forcings like increasing greenhouse gases, aerosols and varying solar radiation.
And this this time series that you referred to, you're talking about measurements made by satellites, right?
That's right. There's AQUA flies a microwave radiometer called AMSR-E. And the way this radiometer works is it actually listens to the natural emission of microwaves from the Earth. And by measuring these microwaves, you can very accurately measure water vapor in the atmosphere. And I didn't say it, but almost all the water in the atmosphere, 99% of the water in the atmosphere, is water vapor. It's invisible. You don't see it when you look up at the sky. You look up the sky, you see clouds and rain. But the clouds and rain are only about 1% of the total water. Almost all the water is in terms of this vapor. And the microwaves can measure the vapor very, very well, very precisely. We use about 10 different satellites, and we piece them all together starting back in the 1980s until today to generate these 25 and 30-year time series of water vapor and rainfall.
And you mentioned that AQUA is just one of a whole fleet of instruments out there in space right now that are looking at what's happening to changes on Earth. How do the measurements by AQUA fit into the larger picture of studying the effects of global warming on precipitation?
Actually, surprisingly, as it turns out, the measurement of water is more accurate than direct measurements of temperature. It's what engineers call a signal-to-noise ratio. And the signal-to-noise ratio for the water measurement is about 7 times higher than the signal-to-noise ratio of the direct temperature measurement that other satellites measure. So we're able to get a more accurate measure of global warming by using the microwave instruments that are on AQUA and also on other satellites. But the measurement of water was one of the first indications that the atmosphere was indeed warming at a fairly hefty rate, as the theory predicts. And that theory is called Clausius-Clapeyron, and it's basically warm air holds more water, and every degree the air increases, it can hold 7% more water.
You've written that that the changes in rainfall across the globe may be one of the most serious risks from climate change. Tell us more about what you meant by that.
Well, yeah, I think it's sort of obvious. I mean, you have world food production, and our world food production, you know, depends critically on rainfall. And we need to know where it will rain and how much rain there's going to be. And if these rain patterns begin to change and intensify, then we need to adapt quickly. We need to adapt our agriculture and crop selections and to match with the new rain patterns. And also there's some very heavily populated regions on the planet, such as Bangladesh, that are already plagued with flooding. And a significant increase in rainfall in these areas would really cause some problems.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about global warming and rainfall?
Okay. Well, maybe for your audience, I don't need to say this, but I'll say it anyway. And that is that global warming is real. It's not a hoax. However, one should not expect a perfectly steady increase in temperature. Having said that, I think we also have to acknowledge that the Earth is an extremely complex system to predict. And as I said, particularly with respect to rainfall, as opposed to simply predicting overall warming. And just the knowledge that we can expect a change should help us in planning. We sort of have to, you know, plan to be adaptive and be ready to, change agricultural plans as we see these things play out.
You've been listening to satellite researcher Frank Wentz, recorded at affiliate station KRCB in Rohnert Park, California. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Beth Lebaugh is here to tell us about wild orchids that are found underground. Beth, what's the story?
Hey there, Jorge. So I really enjoy this story. These orchids are known. Their Latin name is Rhizanthella gardneri. Mm-hmm. And they are orchids that grow naturally underground. In other words, the entire plant, including the blooms, will actually reside several inches, that can be dozens of centimeters, underground. And Earth Sky spoke to a scientist named Etienne Delannoy, who works for an agricultural institute in France, and also in collaboration with Western Australia University.
And what did this scientist study about these wild underground orchids?
He works for an agricultural institute in France, but also with scientists in Western Australia. And he published a paper with his team that appeared in February 2011 in the Journal of Molecular Biology and Evolution. And what he discovered was that this plant does not photosynthesize its own food. That is, most plants will grow towards sunlight. They will use that sun to help them create sugars. That's their food. That's their lunch.
Right, with their leaves and with their petals, their flowers.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But this particular plant doesn't do that. But he found out, Dr. Delannoy did, what this plant does do. It turns out that this orchid is a parasite. So it's evolved a parasitic relationship with an Australian fungus which lives under a plant called Australian broom bush. And the fungus, it's almost like a channel or a funnel. It provides the orchid with mineral nutrients and sugars and water and even carbon dioxide that are coming from the bush. And with these ingredients, the orchid can cook up its own food.
That's amazing. I mean, these underground orchids are, they look a lot like these beautiful orchids that people love to grow and to look at. But this grows underground, and it's in some kind of relationship with this fungus and this broom brush.
Yes, they do look somewhat, in terms of their shape, like an orchid that you might see in a flower shop. But it's almost, the color is very muted. So it's almost like it's a very pale-looking orchid. Another thing that I wanted to add is that Dr. Delanois did a genetic analysis of this flower. There's more to it than just sort of, oh gosh, this plant is a parasite. He found out that this plant has what are called chloroplasts. And here we get a little technical. Chloroplasts are cell subunits with their own genes, which in most plants carry out photosynthesis. Okay. And it turns out that this orchid, even though it doesn't do photosynthesis, it still has these chloroplasts. And so Dr. Delanois said that if they can figure out what the chloroplasts in this special orchid do, it could provide new insights into the critical processes in the lives of all plants.
Right. This could help illuminate, this underground orchid could help illuminate the mysteries of evolution.
Exactly. And the genetic makeup of plants that are in full bloom, in full sun.
Thanks, Beth.
Thank you. I think there's just one more thing that I wanted to add.
Oh, you
got
one more point. Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
There are only 50 known plants of Rosenzella gardneri in the world. And they're, as I said, they're found in Western Australia. But because of their rarity, their location is actually kept secret from the public. So the public doesn't know where to find them, and they can't, but even scientists have difficulty finding them. So Dr. Delanois told us that he had to enlist tremendous amounts of help to even get samples for his study. And it took sometimes many hours of just a single person on his or her knees foraging underground for this plant.
And to save people listening a lot of trouble, they can just come to earthsky.org, and we have pictures of this underground orchid. Thanks, Beth.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebowall, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
In every way, we go together. We are alike, we complement each other. Ah, that's right. At last I have it, even better than I imagined. I can't believe I nearly gave it up. I nearly watched the dream collapsing. I can't believe it, even sleeping I wouldn't dream it. Understandably, I'm feeling satisfied. What an odd and incredible feeling. This is the pinnacle, everything's eventual. Now I'm not sure exactly what I'm waiting for. This is my fantasy, exactly how I dreamed it'd be. What's this? A smile. Goodness, it must have been a while.
And now a story on the science behind one of the biggest and most complex criminal investigations done by the FBI. Alice Gast chaired a committee for the National Research Council that looked at the science behind the evidence of the 2001 anthrax mailings. She's here now to explain what they found. Dr. Gast, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, what are the main findings of the NRC study on the evidence from the 2001 anthrax mailings?
Well, the overarching finding is that the scientific part of the investigation was a part of an overall investigation, and that it's not possible to reach a definitive conclusion about the origins of the bee anthracis in the mailings based on the scientific evidence alone.
Now, tell us about the science testing that went into analyzing these anthrax-causing spores. How does one fingerprint these bacterium spores that cause anthrax?
Well, there are a lot of sciences that came together in this, and I must say that the FBI did an excellent job in reaching out to experts around the country, and there were physical and chemical analyses as well as the microbiological and genetic analyses of the letters. What turned out to be the most important part of this particular study was the observation fairly early on, actually, by a scientist and a technician that the material in the letters would form colonies that had different shapes. They're called morphological variants or morphological mutations, morphotypes, as we call them. What happens when you grow beanthraces, particularly in large spore productions, is that you'll develop these mutations. They're mutations in the sporulation function, the function of the bacterium going into a spore phase. And some of those persist and survive under varying conditions, and so you'll get a population of these different mutants, and then looking at that population and comparing it to populations in other samples allows one to make a link between the two.
And these morphological differences, I mean, just for the benefit of people listening, I mean, you're talking about like the difference in shape of the spores. Could you give us some kind of analogy to help us out?
Actually, that's a great question. I should have started back a little earlier. If you take some of these cells and you plate them out, you know, on a petri dish on a gel plate, and then they start to grow colonies, and so you have that classic picture of circular colonies of bacteria growing on a petri dish, you'll see that some colonies are taking on different shapes than the others, and that's how you can visibly, with a naked eye, observe what are called morphological variants or morphotypes. Then if you take the cells that are growing in that colony, and the colony started from a single cell, and all the cells in that colony will share the same lineage then. That's, you know, it's a blob on this gel, on this petri dish. If you collect those and look at them, you can find the genetic variation on a molecular level that caused or that was manifest in that, seeing that different shape on the gel. So the molecular signature is really what can be used then to compare one sample to another. And the FBI focused on four genetic mutations in these samples in order to screen all the other samples that they collected to look for the presence of those four mutations.
The study also talked about parallel evolution as being a factor used to weigh this anthrax evidence. Would you explain for us what the committee meant by that and a little bit about what that is and why that's important to what we're talking about today?
Sure. I mean, that's one of the issues, that you can't say precisely that you are positive that just because a sample had those four mutations that they came about because of the creation of a sample at a particular time. What can happen is, I like to think of it as a large batch of these bacteria growing, and they start running out of food or nutrients. They will go into their spore phase, and that's the interesting thing about spore-forming materials, and they can sit in a spore phase for a long time and then reemerge when they're presented with a host environment where they can grow again. If they start going into their spore phase and then they are given more nutrients, those cells that were slow to form spores are faster to start taking up nutrients and growing and multiplying again. So you can see a population of cells that was deficient in its sporulation and couldn't form spores as easily will become predominant because it starts growing faster when it comes out of sporulation. So you get these mixed populations, and that can evolve quite naturally depending upon how long the cells have been grown, how many generations they've been grown, what the conditions were, whether they were starved of nutrients or all different kinds of conditions just for the cell growth. So over time, depending upon those conditions, you can have these mutations evolving in almost any given cell population.
I mean, so I guess you're saying that the committee explored this possibility that even though the spores from the letters looked like the spores that were in possession by the suspect, they may not be positively linked. I mean, one may not be the parent of the other. It just may be a chance that they are very similar. Is that right? Or?
Yeah, in some sense, it raises the fact that you can't make an absolute link between those samples because there are other scenarios because of the fact that B-anthracis readily forms various mutations of this type. There are other scenarios that you could think of where those mutants would develop through their own evolutionary processes.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about the scientific review of evidence from the case of the 2001 anthrax mailings?
I think a very important thing that the public should understand is that they need to recognize that science is not absolute. And when it comes into a courtroom, I fear that sometimes it's put on a higher pedestal or treated as an absolute. And there are uncertainties in science, just as there are uncertainties in other pieces of evidence. I think communicating clear expectations of what one can get from these types of investigations is very important during the process and when presenting the results of an investigation. But the public also has to understand that just because it may sound high-tech to them doesn't mean it's ironclad.
That was chemical engineer Alice Gast, president of Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. That's our show. Thanks for joining us on Earth Sky. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Black and White Years, Sleep Good, and 100 Flowers. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.